Coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we discuss Prospect Theatre Company's production of The Underclassmen. Lynn Ahrens and Stephen Flaherty are honored by the York Theatre Company. The Irish Repertory Theatre's production of A Christmas Memory, Rollo's Wild Ode at Metropolitan Playhouse, and Playwrights Horizon's production of Grand Concourse. That plus some news. Please stay tuned.
It was winter in New York as the snow began to fall, and the workman's hall had not a seat to spare. When a young man ducked inside just to warm himself was all, the night that Goldman spoke at Union Square.
Yes, this is the land of opportunity, but opportunity for men like Mr. J.P. Morgan.
She was speaking loud and fast through a haze of noise and heat and the smell of sweat and anger in the air. The police were standing by, but the crowd was on its feet the night that Goldman spoke at Union Square.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for the week of November 30th, 2014. My name is James Marino, and the broadcasts this morning are Peter Felicia and Michael Partantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being Strippers, Showgirls, and Sharks. His columns appear at MTI, Critchland, Masterworks, Broadway, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
So a note for our listeners and everybody else out there is that we have moved our release schedule to pretty much a Friday-Saturday schedule. So you should be receiving this show on December 5th or 6th, depending upon where you are in the world. And, you know, it's just a little change that we're making to see if we can increase our listenership. But the best way for us to increase our listenership is for you to go on Facebook or Twitter or tell your friends to list, to download and just listen to one show, see if they like it or not, and turn people onto it. It's really great if we can grow our audience that way. This week on Broadway has been coming to you mostly every week since March 16, 2009, and is the longest running Broadway and theatrical podcast with more than 300 shows, giving thousands of reviews and hundreds of interviews. And if folks like Broadway and theater or West End or wherever else you are in the world and doing theater, this might be something that is interesting to them. So please turn folks on to it. This morning, we're going to talk about The Underclassmen. Michael and Peter got a chance to see that. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Yes. This had a genesis of Broadway, and here it is moving to a better venue. By two very, very talented people, a husband and wife team, Kara Reichel and Peter Mills. She basically directs, he basically writes the score. They've also collaborated on the book in this one. And this is about F. Scott Fitzgerald when he was at Princeton and his adventures there. Peter Mills is one of these people who astonishes me that he's not on Broadway. Kara, too. They are so talented. They keep putting out work endlessly. I don't know where they find the time to do it, but with their company, the Prospect Theatre Company, they have done one compelling musical after the other. And I would expect that somebody would come to them by now and say, please write us a musical, whether that be a producer, whether that be a star. But these people are too marvelous to be ignored. That said, I'm afraid the story of F. Scott Fitzgerald, while he was at Princeton, doesn't seem to be that interesting. it's a traditional story about falling in love with a girl and her playing hard to get, and a friend dies in a car crash, things like that. It's never made as fascinating as we want it to be. That's the real problem with it. It just goes on. However, if there's an original cast album of this show, I know I'm going to play it endlessly. Peter Mills is very, very skillful at replicating the era. The songs sound as if they belong in 1915, maybe a little later, but of course the college crowd is always a little ahead when it comes to music, at least in those days. So all things considered, the best part of the score, I'm sorry, the best part of the show is definitely the score, where tuneful I don't know where this man gets this melody from. No matter what era he seems to be in, he seems to be able to capture it perfectly, and he's done it again here. So please, somebody, would you get us an original cast album of The Underclassmen? What's also interesting is that we deal with the Princeton Triangle show. This is a show where the guys dress up as girls. I don't know if they still do. I know the Hasty Pudding show has been integrated at Harvard, but where the guys dress up as girls and they put on skits and parodies and of the day. And this is shown to good effect too here, where the guys get involved with the club. So you have production numbers that indicate what the Triangle shows were like, or perhaps are like. I have been to one in at least 20 years. So the germs of his becoming a writer is definitely there. And it seems to be officially based, at least the program tells us, on This Side of Paradise, a novel I am embarrassed to say I've never read. So I don't know how closely it follows that. But I guess if This Side of Paradise does involve the Princeton Triangle show, I guess I should read it just for that alone. But the fact that it's considered a great work of literature should be enough for me, too. So I guess that's my next assignment, to read This Side of Paradise. But your assignment, if it's still running, is to definitely hear this score. Good lyrics, too. I mean, he does some fascinating rhymes. I mean, all these years, how come nobody's ever rhymed sophomore with offamore? that's good, you know. And there's one involving mathematics, too, that's pretty clever as well. So all hail Peter Mills, all hail Kara Reichel for their work as songwriter and director. Maybe they should get a book writer, though, to make the story more interesting.
We should try to get Peter and Kara on.
And they're a lovely couple. They really are. So,
all right. So it's running at the Duke on 42nd Street through November 9th. Michael, what did you think about it?
December 9th?
Oh, through December. Whoa, what did I do here? let's see.
It's all right.
Did I get it wrong? Oh, no. Performances begin November 9th. Oh.
Okay. All right.
All right. Well, Michael, what did you think of the show?
I completely agree about the talent of Mills and Reichel. I am not as familiar with them as Peter seems to be, especially the music. I really thought it was just superb. The lyrics, too, although I felt that there were several cases where they were so clever that they drew attention to themselves in a bad way. And also, you know what I noticed? Three or four different times, there were these really interesting interior rhymes that would have been great, except that the accent was on the wrong syllable or whatever, and that really hurt them. There was nothing wrong with the rhymes themselves. It was just the way that the words, the syllables fell on the notes. And it was weird because I thought to myself, well, if he had just made that a quarter note and the other one a half note, then the rhythm would have been the same. And then it would have been a much more effective rhyme. So I don't know why that happened. And I'd like to hear the cast album also, so I can hear if I was right about that, and if it would be that easy to improve those. But really, there were several. Peter alluded to two of them, and there were a few others. I felt the show was also a little too overstuffed in terms of so many songs. All of them really great, but just maybe too many songs for the story. As Peter says, not a lot happens. There is one death of a secondary character that occurs, and that's really about the only major bit of drama during the whole thing. Other than that, it's just him, his relationship with this woman named Ginevra, this schoolgirl also, and how that's going to proceed and if they're going to get together. And then you're wondering how she fits into the larger F. Scott Fitzgerald story. I will say that Zelda is mentioned just once at the very end, I guess giving us an idea of what he's going to go on to. It's interesting also to note this this show has been, in one form or another, has been in development for at least 10 years. It says received initial developmental support in 2004 as part of the new Director's New Works program of the Drama League of New York. But at that time, the title was The Pursuit of Persephone, which is actually the title of the a show within the show that the Triangle Club is putting on, and which we see two or three different is that right? Yeah. With some of the guys in drag, as Peter mentioned. I'm not sure exactly when the title was changed. Frankly, I don't think either title is that great.
I agree. Yeah.
And I do wonder if they did not have the rights to call it This Side of Paradise, because I think that would have been said a lot more about what you know, what the show is and what we're going to see. We really should mention the cast, a huge cast for a production on this level. I didn't actually count 19 or 20 people. And actually, a friend of mine knows someone in the cast, and I parenthetically said after the show, I said, "What a huge cast!" And he said, I won't say the number, but let's just say that they weren't not being paid very well, because this show probably would not have been able to be done on any level if they had received a salary that was more commensurate with off-Broadway or even off-Broadway. But we did get to see it, that's something that we can all be grateful for, and I do look forward to the recording also. Matt Dengler, really yeoman work, just really quite a tour de force, I would say, as F. Scott Fitzgerald. He has a tremendous amount of material, lots of singing, and lots of lines. Jessica Grove, who many of our listeners will be familiar with, was Ginevra, and the entire cast really, really superb. I want to single out Marek Smith as John Peel Bishop, one of the more interesting characters, because it's never stated, it's only strongly implied, and maybe only in one moment, that he may be in love with Fitzgerald. But the fact that it is so subtle makes it all the more powerful. And Marek Smith, who apparently was a fairly late addition to the cast, because someone else's name appears on the original flyers that I received. I'm not sure what happened there. But he really did a beautiful job of communicating the emotions of this character, John Peel Bishop. So you have a little more time to get to see it, and I would urge you to do so if you can. I think this show could, as long as it has been being worked on, I think it could stand another pass or two, mostly for edits, I would say. There's no reason why it has to be one act, and maybe it shouldn't. But I did feel like there were a lot of diversions, and that it was overstuffed, as I said before. So maybe it could just be made a little leaner, and that would work better in terms of the story not being so terribly compelling, as Peter mentioned.
Yeah, the other thing I have to say, though, even though it was long, it moved very well.
Oh, yes.
And I didn't feel like I was there as long as I was, which was about close to 2.5 hours. It didn't feel it to me. So, again, this is a nice tribute to Kara Reichel, who really is a sure-handed director. I couldn't help wondering, though, you know, I'm a big fan of Beautiful. And I think that the writing is pretty spectacular in that it's a very common story. It's one we've heard a million times. And yet it seems like we're hearing it for the first time based on the quality of the writing. They really make you care about that girl. And this is a very familiar story, too. And yet It didn't make me care as much about the characters as I wanted to. Maybe Doug McGrath could come in and help on writing The Underclassmen, because if he does, it might turn out to move me as much as the situations in Beautiful have moved me. So I just wish I cared more. I just couldn't. So, but I liked Jessica Grove too, very, very much. I thought she was terrific, and I'm telling you, this is a team you are going to hear from in the years to come, and it's amazing to me that. Michael, you mentioned the fact that they weren't getting much money, the cast and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm sure that's true. But the thing is, this Prospect Theater Company has been around for a while now, I guess at least 10 years. And the fact that they keep going and making it happen while so many other companies bite the dust in the period of time that they've been around, whatever they're doing, whatever magic they're making, however they're convincing people to work with them for little or no money, okay. But they're making it happen. And I think that's pretty remarkable, but the work warrants it in terms of that music, the lyrics, and direction.
And I've heard Peter Mills's name mentioned many times in recent years as one of the great hopes of the American musical theater, and I can see why. Who knows exactly why? Nothing on Broadway yet, but I'm assuming and hoping it's just a matter of time.
Well, yeah, he has a wonderful sense of humor. There was a review he did on 47th Street. I think the word taxi was involved. I don't remember the actual name of the review, but there was a scene in which the seven continents are speaking. who thinks of something like that? I mean, each continent talks about, and it turns out that Europe and Asia used to be together, and now that one is still upset that the other broke up with him, and the other continent says that was a million years ago, and that's a very good line, because we always say that when we're trying to indicate something has happened a long time ago, that was a million years ago, and what we really mean is 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, but this really was a million years ago that Asia and Europe broke up, and Asia's still not over it, or Europe wasn't over it. I mean, that's an interesting mind, that's somebody who's really giving a lot of thought to what he's doing. So so yes, Peter Mills, watch for him.
So unfortunately, it is closing today, the 30th, this afternoon.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, I'm the one that said November 9th. So, so November 30th, it's a 21-day run, I guess, the 9th to the 30th. And hopefully we will see more of them. And like I said, I'm going to try to get them on to let's talk about their career for Peter and Kara. All right, let's move on to another writing team of Aarons and Flaherty, where they were just given a tribute by the York Theatre Company, and Peter got a chance to attend that on Monday the 24th. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about that?
Well, the wonderful thing about Aarons and Flaherty is they really write in the great Broadway tradition. Technically, Flaherty was just about 30 years old when he burst onto the Broadway scene with Once on This Island. And he definitely is of a younger generation, and certainly somebody who was brought up in the world of rock. And yet, for whatever reason, his writing style has rarely involved rock. I recall when he told me that when he was doing Rocky, this would be his first rock musical. But for the most part, that isn't the case. So perhaps the most moving point in this tribute to Aarons and Flaherty, where they received the Oscar Hammerstein Award that the York gives out annually, was hearing Terrence McNally getting up and speaking and saying, I wish you could have been there. I was there, and I feel very privileged when Stephen came in and played the first notes of Ragtime. And, suddenly we did hear some of that music, and it brought home to us again that this truly is one of the great musicals of the last 50 years. Their work on it is superb, and Maren Mazzie got up and sang Back to Before, which was certainly one of the highlights of the evening, tore the house down tremendously. The evening ended with Make Them Hear You, which they certainly have done over the years. They have made us hear them, and we're luckier for it. Some of this had to do, too, with the fact that this weekend, we're going to see my favorite year at York. And supposedly they've done a lot of work on it. And I'm sure that's not a bad thing. But I've always felt that one of the reasons my favorite year failed on Broadway, and I use the term on Broadway with quotation marks, was the fact that it was not actually in a Broadway theater as we know it. It was at Lincoln Center. And this is an old-fashioned musical, and I mean that as a compliment, set in 1954. And it doesn't lend itself to the type of stage that the Vivian Beaumont is, a thrust stage. It needs a proscenium arch to surround it. And so I think my favorite year is going to come across very, very well this year when we see it this weekend. So I found it interesting that they didn't do my favorite year, either the opening number or the closing number, which I think are two of the best opening and closing numbers of the last quarter century. The last song is the title song, and it truly is a honey. But Lynn and Steve also are well known as nice people, and they certainly seemed it when they got up to accept the Oscar Hammerstein Award. They do have this lovely demeanor about them. They're professional, certainly. And Steve announced too that he and his longtime beau Trevor will be getting married soon. So that was nice as well to hear that officially.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. You know, I mean, whether it be Jason Donnelly, whether it be Bobby Steggert, who is one of our certainly our emerging stars. Well, he's emerged to say the least. But Judy Kaye was there as well. Certainly, Ramin Karimloo was there. Andy Carl, who somehow to me looks smaller in real life than he did on stage in Rocky. That was pretty surprising to me. So Kenita Miller was there to do songs from Once in This Island, especially Waiting for Life to Begin, which is such a great song. So it was just nice to have the retrospective. This is a team that, while it has been heralded, is one that I think really deserves even more accolades. And I'm certainly looking forward to seeing what they're doing next. They didn't announce that, but I guess because they've been busy with My Favorite Year. But I look forward to seeing that this weekend at the York Musical in Mufti.
Well, another reason to look forward to it is that Benji Stone is being played by Adam Chandler Barat, and Alan Swan is being played by Douglas Sills.
Yeah, that's really nice they got him.
I mean, that sounds like incredibly great casting in both cases. Mm-hmm. I really cannot wait to see that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good. I'm glad you're going. That's great.
I love My Favorite Year. I wonder why it hasn't been ever bantered around as a revival. Have you guys ever heard about somebody thinking
But obviously that's what they have in mind if they're doing all this work on it, you know. So I will tell you, I remember watching the movie after seeing the show and thinking that in some ways they improved it. The story with the duck joke, I think, is much more much more effective in the musical than it is in the movie.
I love the duck joke.
So, oh, I'm glad you do. It's funny, you know. I'm going to watch it again before I see the show, so I can be more articulate than I am right now, because it's been a while since I've seen the picture. But it brings up Adolph Green, who's in the movie as well, and I have to say,
right.
I spent a very nice afternoon this past week with not only Amanda Green, his daughter, but with Phyllis Newman, his wife of 42 years, and hearing one story after the other. I'm going to not tell the stories because I'm going to use it in my column at mtishows.com this week. But some of these stories are hilarious, especially one involving Singing in the Rain, which I urge you to tune in. Just read the last paragraph, okay? You don't want to read the whole thing? All right, fine. I understand. But read the last paragraph, because it really is a honey of a story.
Wow. I'm really looking forward to what you guys have to say about My Favorite Year, because I would love to see somebody take another swing at that. And because I think it sounds so cliche, but I really think that it's a great family show.
Yes, it is, isn't it? You know, especially with the fact that they underline the father-son relationship, which was something that really wasn't in the movie. They were criticized for that, and we'll see if they feel that ultimately was for better or worse. We'll see what happens with the changes. But don't expect to go seeing Business as Usual with My Favorite Year. I think they said 9 songs. I could be wrong about that. Don't hold me to that. But I think we're going to see either a total of 9 different songs, or maybe 5 new ones and 4 drop something. 9, I think, is very much in the title.
Well, 9 was the number for that we heard for Sideshow. So I guess to be the magic number. But I'll tell you, I don't know if I think my take on the original production was that it people seem to feel it didn't work for some really hard to define reason or reasons, and it wasn't necessarily the writing. I saw musicals tonight do it several years later when they were briefly down on 14th Street. Did you see anything when they did shows down there?
I didn't see that one. Yes.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, I'm sitting there watching it, and I was like, there is nothing wrong with this show. So I don't know if it was overproduced. The first time I didn't think so. Maybe there was some issues with the direction or some of the casting, and it just didn't gel. But that was my impression then. So I.
All right, but did the Proscenium Arch issue ever occur to you? Does that hold water for you? Does that make any sense to you?
Oh, I don't know. That's an interesting point.
All right, we'll see. We'll see.
Yeah.
So I didn't see My Favorite Year. Because it played December 10th, 1992 to January 10th, 1993. And I was out of town that whole period of time. I was down in Jupiter, Florida at the Jupiter Theater, their old Burt Reynolds Theater. And so I totally missed it. So I only know it from the recording. And I'm not sure. I don't think that I saw it up at Lincoln Center on tape. But, but I wonder, A, if it, that's December 10th to open up a show. That's a rough time to open up a show.
I suppose that's true.
What else was happening that season?
Well, but you know, but that's perfect for an institutional theater like Lincoln Center. If anyone's going to open a show at that time,
They played for their subscribers and then they were done, because who the hell sells tickets in January?
Would you say 92, 93?
December 10th, 1992 to January 10th, 1993.
Okay, so that was the season. Admittedly, these shows came later, but that was the season of Kiss of the Spider-Woman, The Who's Tommy, and Blood Brothers. So they came later, I'll grant you. But anyway, if we're trying to detail what the season was, that was that season. But I also attended the recording session, which was made after the fact. That's always so moving when you see these people when the show has been closed, knowing they're really, really doing it for the last time. And the pain in their faces, and yet the joy in their faces, and the bravery is really something to see. The recording sessions I've been to, the shows that are, of course, running at that time, is almost like, well, let's get it done. I mean, sure, there's fun involved, and they know that they're recording for the ages and all that. But when you know you're doing it for the real last time, that's incredibly moving. So, and they were so brave, especially when singing a song saying My Favorite Year, which in a way it was and in a way it wasn't. I mean, because I'm sure for a lot of them it was their favorite year because they got into a Broadway show. And yet for a lot of them it wasn't their favorite year because they certainly expected it to be a longer experience than it turned out to be.
Yeah, so I'm looking at the season: 3 from Brooklyn, A Christmas Carol, Ain't Broadway Grand, Angels in America, Millennium, Anna Christie, Anna Karenina, Blood Brothers, Candida, Chinese Coffee Company Revival, Face Value, Full Moon, Gypsy Passion. I don't know what that is.
You don't know what Passion is?
No, Gypsy Passion.
Oh.
Gypsy Passion. Kiss the Spider-Woman.
That's funny. 2 Sondheim titles, you know.
Yeah. My Favorite Year. Oba Oba, Rafi, Redwood Curtain, St. Joan, Salome, Shakespeare for My Father, Solitary Confinement, Someone Who Watch Over Me.
Oh.
Tango Passion. Gypsy Passion and Tango Passion.
I tell you. I don't know either of those shows at all.
Yeah. The Boys Choir of Harlem and Friends, which was just a concert for a few nights. Goodbye Girl. The Goodbye Girl. Oh. That was a train wreck.
Another show.
Based on a movie, yeah. The Real Inspector Hound and the 15-minute Hamlet. The Seagull, The Show Off, Song of Jacob Zulu, Who's Tommy, Three Men on a Horse, Tommy Tune Tonight, and Wilder, Wilder, Wilder. And so that was the season. So some of those obviously opened up before and some of them opened up after. Yeah. But I still contend that it's very tough to open a new musical without huge stars in it in January. So maybe that it was a bad timing situation.
Of course, there are some who would say that Tim Curry was a huge star as a result of one of those movies he made in the 70s that certainly showed up late at night on Saturdays in various theaters around the country.
Because the folks that I see at the Rocky Horror Picture Show on Friday and Saturday nights at midnight at theaters are typically the Broadway audience, right? Which is the issue that probably Jordan
brought. I don't know, but yeah, well, this reminds me of I'll never forget when I went to see Charlie Brown, the revival that made Christian Chenoweth a star.
Yeah.
That revival that was at the Ambassador. Adam Rapp came on. I'm sorry, am I right? Anthony Rapp, who's the kid who was
Anthony.
In Rent?
Anthony.
Okay, the kid who's in Rent. You know, he came on, and the crowd goes crazy. You know, and it's the opening number, and there's Charlie Brown just coming out to do his little section that Andrew Lipper wrote for him. And I'm telling you, the crowd goes crazy, and these are obviously Rent heads. Who now, I'll grant you, the difference is that we're talking about a movie audience and a theater audience. While Rent, of course, was a theater audience, and we're talking about another theater audience. But still, I would think that Tim Curry would get some sort of interest from those people who had seen him play Frank N. Furter 20, 30, 50, 170 times. I would think that they would want to at least have some sort of curiosity. Maybe they showed up at the stage door for autographs and that was the end of it. But considering the mystique that movie had, especially at that time, was that still prime time? I don't know if that was still prime time for my son who hates Broadway with a passion. I went out to California to visit him. He said, hey, this is back in the early 90s. Hey, well, you got to see this thing. You won't believe it. It's really great. And he took me to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And I'm telling you, he knew every line. He saw these people yelling back to the screen, so on and so forth. So as a result, when it was done, I said, Jason, that's actually based on a stage musical that played London and Broadway. He never went to it again.
Oh no. Speaking of Charlie Brown, Kristen Chenoweth, Anthony Rapp, did you guys see Kristen Chenoweth's concert on PBS?
Mm-mm.
No, I missed it.
It was this weekend, and got a lot of play. I wonder if is Kristen still scheduled to do
yes.
on the 20th Century?
Yes.
And I see a lot of play about Idina's launch of her worldwide tour, so I guess the if-then days are numbered.
One thing I did see last night, which was absolutely fantastic, was the Midtown Men.
Oh, yeah.
As recorded, taped, filmed, whatever word you use now, at NJ PAC some time ago. Really incredibly well done concert. Not only the performance, but the editing and the sound quality. It was great. The Midtown Men, for those listeners who don't know, are four members of the original cast of Jersey Boys: Michael Longoria, Daniel Reichard, J. Robert Spencer, and Christian Hoff. And they formed a group where they sing a few songs from Jersey Boys, but also just lots of different numbers from primarily the 60s. I think there might be some 70s in it also, but they bill it as music of the 60s. Full out, you know, harmonies and choreography, and they have solos, and they have lots of group numbers and duets and things like that. And it really was, they've developed an amazing following. They performed all over the country. And it's so fantastic that they have this incredible video audio document of their show now. And they also are going to be coming up at the Beacon Theater in April. So check that out, because they and you may have trouble getting a ticket if you don't try soon, because their popularity is completely deserved. It's a wonderful thing that they put together here.
That's great. Michael, you got a chance to see A Christmas Memory. Did I get that correct?
Yes, and it's funny because I tend to say A Christmas Story, which of course is something completely different. The Christmas Story is the somewhat snarky tale that we all know from the film and also the Broadway musical now. But
which is currently playing in Northport, Long Island, in case anybody wants to go. And the production, I hear, is pretty good. Anyway, go on.
At the Engman?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Oh, yes. Yes, I got an email from them. Thanks for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. But A Christmas Memory is based on a short story by Truman Capote that has been adapted several times, most famously as a beautiful 1966 TV film starring Geraldine Page. And it's a largely autobiographical story of Capote's childhood, where he was living with a well, sometimes he defines her as a cousin, sometimes as an aunt, somewhat distant relative, and much older woman, who is not named in the original story, but later he said or he wrote about her later, and her name was Sook, S-O-O-K, and it's about this really beautiful relationship between this young boy and this much older woman who's very childlike in certain ways, just a very loving, simple woman. Geraldine Page won an Emmy for her performance, and it is truly a performance for the ages. I just found out yesterday that you can watch the entire thing on YouTube. Put in A Christmas Memory, Geraldine Page, and you'll get not one but two complete versions of it. One is in black and white for some reason, so don't watch that one. Watch the other one. It's in four different parts. And it's a beautiful, beautiful story. This has been made into a flawed but lovely musical by a book by Duane Poole, music by Larry Grossman, and lyrics by Carol Hall. And Larry Grossman and Carol Hall, of course, have been in the business for decades, and both are very well respected. But I believe this is quite a new piece. I mean, not brand new, but I don't think it's been kicking around for lots of years, like some of the other things we discuss. And I would say that they did a very good job of adapting it and made only one mistake. The original story and the TV film both focus really almost completely on those two characters that I mentioned. The other characters are very peripheral. There's a store manager, a person who owns a general store, I should say, to whom they go to buy ingredients for the fruitcakes that they make every year. There are other relatives in the house, but they really just make brief appearance, two very brief appearances in the TV film, and I believe in the book. And then there's this fellow, this very colorful character named Ha Ha Jones, who sells them the moonshine whiskey that they use to make the fruitcakes. They put a little of that in as a special ingredient, and he, I think, is supposed to be at least part Native American. But all of these people are just very, very peripherally in the story and in the TV film. In the musical, and I can understand why they did it, the creators expanded those roles, and I think it was a mistake, especially in Act Two. There's a relative named Jenny, played by Nancy Hess, and they spend too much time on her objecting to the relationship between Sook and Buddy, and talking about sending Buddy off to military school, and I just don't think the audience is really that interested in that. Also, this on one level is very interesting, but I didn't again think it was necessary. They have added the character only mention in passing in the story and not in the TV film at all of Nellie Harp. Well, excuse me, Nell Harper is her name, and she's supposed to be Harper Lee, who was a childhood friend of Capote at the time. So, I mean, it's interesting to see this iteration of the young Harper Lee on stage, and her interactions with Buddy were sweet. But again, I think not the heart of what the musical is about. This is really a case where, similar to what we were discussing before, I think that the musical would be improved if they cut some of those songs, those peripheral songs. There's another very long song in Act Two, a very long sequence called Buddy's Midnight Adventure, about this completely separate little adventure that he has. And it takes us away from the story at the moment when we really just want to see what's going to happen. You know, how long is Buddy going to stay with Sook, and what's, you know, are they going to stay in touch over the years, or what's going to occur there? So I think that they should, well, what I think they should do is cut those songs and just make it a one act musical and focus back again on the on those two central characters, which also would have been, as it turns out, the better approach for this production, because it is not being done. It's an Irish rep production, but it's not being done at their usual theater, which is undergoing a renovation that I'm told is going to take about a year and a half. So during that time, they're going to be performing at the DR2 theater down on 15th Street. And the DR2, mind you, not the larger theater. The stage is the word postage stamp would not be too much of an exaggeration. It's very tiny. And I felt that that even though it's only seven people in the cast, the stage was extremely crowded at several points, and it made for some difficult blocking. So, of course, they didn't know it was going to be done there. Maybe they intended it to be done on the main stage at the Irish Rep, and then they had to adapt. But it would have been, as it turns out, it would have been better. And I wonder if they might consider, again, giving another pass to the material, because there is a lot that's really beautiful there. Larry Grossman is a wonderful composer who really never had a hit, just for, you know, circumstances. Carol Hall, best known, of course, as writing the music and lyrics for The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. But she's written other wonderful stuff, too. And Truman Capote, it's interesting to note. Several of his pieces have been adapted for the musical theater, and one can completely understand why, because of the poetry and the rich characters. But none of the adaptations of his work has been a hit. We had The Grass Harp, we had House of Flowers, and we had Breakfast at Tiffany's. Maybe there are more that I don't know about, but it's not easy, obviously. But I do understand why people keep trying, and I think this one almost gets there. Really, it does.
All right. So let's move on to the our next thing, and that's Peter got a chance to see, let me get this correct, Rollo's Wild Oat at the Metropolitan Playhouse.
One wild oat. Not usually the expression is wild oats, and it usually means sexual activities. Not in this case. Not at all. This is a play from 1920. Claire Cummer, who was a Boulevard comedy playwright at the time. So, and this is what Michael Hardart does so well. He finds these plays from years ago that nobody has thought of for close to a century, and puts them up in enchantingly delightful productions. He is such a terrific director where it comes to these old shows, and this is no exception. I will grant you, the 2 hours and 40 minutes is awfully long for a comedy, and again, how did people do it in those days when shows started at 8:30 and this is a three-act show and they only put in one intermission. So But anyway, the story, Rollo is going to sow his wild oat, but it is not sexual at all. What he's going to do with the money his grandfather has given him, the grandfather's still alive, by the way, but the grandfather has given him and his sister money and go and do something productive. And what he's decided to do is put on a production of Hamlet, in which he will play Hamlet. So the grandfather's appalled because this is a very high-toned family, and having anything to do with acting is something that is not to be. He's intent on doing it. Nothing's going to stop him, and it isn't long before he finds his ideal Ophelia, whose name is Goldie McDuff. Nothing has made the fact that McDuff is a term we use for a different play in Shakespeare. But she has no experience whatsoever. She's really just a relation of the man who's going to be the manager of the show, meaning producer. That's the term they used in those days. And but he is intent on using her because he is just head over heels in love with her. Well, again, this is a very slight story, isn't it? And 2 hours and 40 minutes may be too long for it. However, the production is so wonderful, and I have to really commend to the nth degree Kevin Sebastian playing Rollo and Erica Knight playing Goldie. They are such an adorable couple. You root for them like crazy, and that's the power of the show, that you want to see them get together. They have all these roadblocks ahead of them. But equally as fine, really tremendously, wonderfully played, is David Licht playing the grandfather, Horatio. Those are the names those grandfathers had in those days, didn't they? Horatio, the quintessential WASP, who is looking down on how his grandson is spending the money. But also what's important is there's a tremendous bond between these two. And this is smart to – more playwrights should really investigate doing plays with grandparents and grandchildren as opposed to fathers and sons or mothers and daughters, because the relationship is very different. There is usually much more affection between grandparents and grandchildren. And so when things go wrong, there isn't as much blame attached. There isn't as much chaos. And people have to act much more civilly because there's more love involved, because there wasn't that day-to-day friction that children have with their parents. And that's one of the strengths of Claire Beecher Cummer's play, Rollo Wild Oat. It's playing till December 20th. I recommend it highly.
Peter, I had to go away for a second, so I may have missed it. And this may be a stupid question, but is that a woman?
Claire, yeah.
Because I know sometimes that's a...
Of course, yeah. It's also a nickname for Clarence, because in Life with Father,
right,
he's always being referred to as Claire.
Right.
So, yeah.
Interesting.
So, the last thing that we're going to talk about this morning is Peter got a chance to see the not the Grand Concourse, but Grand Concourse at Playwrights Horizons. So, Peter, tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a very, very good play. Heidi Schreck, who we mostly know as an actress, has written a play, and it's a very, very good one. Grand Concourse takes place in the soup kitchen, where, as one employee there mentions, what is made there is bum soup, meaning soup that is given to homeless people or people who are down on their luck. And we meet one of them, played by Lee Wilcoff, who has been around for a nice long time, has done everything from She Loves Me to a little review called The Present Tense at the Park Royale almost 40 years ago, for which he really scored a big hit. So Heidi Schreck's play deals with day-to-day living in this Bronx soup kitchen. Well, everything is day-to-day. I mean, you just deal with everybody who comes in. But suddenly there is a new person coming in. Okay, now, so we meet Shelley, who has been doing it for years, and she is a nun. She doesn't dress as a nun. She's a New World nun, but she is a nun. And And she needs help very badly. So in comes Emma, who says she wants to volunteer. So, of course, you're going to take her, aren't you? Perhaps part of the message of the play is be careful who you accept as a volunteer, because chaos really can ensue. What becomes more arresting about the play than we might have guessed is that it also deals with the matter of faith, that this nun is having a very, very hard time with her faith. She is someone who has seen so much in the soup kitchen and the people around her that it's very hard to believe that God, that God is really around. Why isn't he helping people more? Well, what eventually happens is she loses her faith for a very strange and unique reason. I'm certainly not going to tell why, but that's the real conflict in the play, how she loses her faith. Now, you must see the play not only because it's quite wonderful, but also for Quincy Tyler Bernstein, who plays Shelley the nun. It's the finest performance I've seen this season by an actress in a play. Wow. So Ismenia Mendez is really good as Emma as well. And certainly Bobby Moreno is on tap too to play the guy who supposedly helps out, one of these guys who does help out and doesn't help out and is inured to his job and isn't very devoted to it. But the real power of the play is watching Quincy Tyler Bernstein as Shelley deal with matters of faith and morals and come to a conclusion that I dare say you won't see coming. So I think Grand Concourse is really quite an event.
Mm. So it's it has gotten such outstanding reviews. Do we think that it's going to have a future?
I'd like to see it. By the way, while it's at Playwrights Horizons, may I point out it's not in their main stage. It's upstairs at the Peter Sharp Theater, which is a very small space. Hyper-realistic kitchen set and that really points out what it's like, almost prison-like. Working in a place like this is very, very difficult, no question. And I will tell you that if you don't like your job, you might very well feel better about it when you go to see Grand Concourse.
So today is the last day of this production, November.
We're talking about all these shows that closed. I didn't realize that.
November 30th, but maybe we'll see this in the spring.
I hope so.
We'll see another theater that will open up for it and take it from there. All right, so let's wrap up. Anything you guys want to mention before we go? What are you doing this week?
What am I doing this week? I'm going to see Elf at the Paper Mill Playhouse. I'm looking forward to that because I think it's a really nice musical. So I think that'll be certainly worthwhile. And my favorite year, certainly. So I don't remember what my other plans are.
I somehow failed to mention that that Alice Ripley is the star of A Christmas Memory, and I did not want to fail to mention that.
Oh.
She has obviously many, many fans, and it's interesting that she's doing this at a time when Sideshow happens to be back on Broadway. I'm told that she has been to Sideshow, and it was covered in the press. I'm not sure if it was the first preview or the opening or whatever, but she definitely was a presence there, and I'm sure people were thrilled to see her and will be thrilled to see her on stage again as Sook. So that's people should know that. James, you mentioned a few weeks ago in passing, I wanted to bring up again Carols for a Cure. Mm-hmm. The new CD has been out for a while, and it has several notable things on it, including a number with the Company of the Last Ship featuring Sting, called Soul Cake. And then there are lots of other interesting items, fun items here. Les Miserables, I Saw Three Ships, Pippin, Cast of Pippin does What Child Is This, Aladdin, Cast Aladdin does We Three Kings, Cast of Motown does two numbers, Another Christmas Eve and I Am Here, and Matilda, those people do One Good Thing. One Good Thing. On the Town, the company does Christmas Eve in My Hometown. So it's a two-disc set. I think they usually are So you really might want to pick that up for a very good cause.
What year is this? How many have they done now?
Oh, gosh.
It's got to be 17 or 18.
Does it say that? Usually they give a Roman numeral, don't they?
Carol's.
Volume 16.
Wow, isn't that something?
Volume 16, yeah.
Isn't it wonderful if that series has been able to continue?
Yes, and more than that, but I guess it is 16, yeah. And it's a two-disc set.
Always, yeah.
Yeah, I was thinking that, I mean, of course, initially Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS was aimed at raising funds to help people for the AIDS crisis. AIDS is still very much with us, but it is not, quite the same level of incredible tragic crisis that it was at one point. So, but this wonderful charity was already established, very well established, and I think that there was no thought of letting it just go. So they have adapted themselves, and they give a great amount of money now to other causes, such as the Phyllis Newman Women's Health Initiative. But then they also give money; they help out with things like Hurricane Sandy and things like that.
Did you guys see any of the production numbers on the Thanksgiving Day Parade?
Mm-mm. Any good?
Sting did the last ship number, and he was great.
Oh, good.
He was great. I'm like, I wasn't so hot on the show, but I'm thinking about going back to see it because I think Sting was really, really good. And Honeymoon in Vegas was great. And I think everybody came off really well.
A lot of people. I didn't see most of it, but I heard that many people felt that On the Town came across extremely well.
Yes, yeah, I have heard that. Yeah.
The opening number, yeah.
And speaking of Compton and Green, again, Peter Pan this week. So they appeared too, right? Peter Pan, did you see that on the parade?
Yeah, Peter Pan was there too as well.
Did you see the documentary the other night? There was the making of Peter Pan that was on Thursday night, taking us through the process of the rehearsal and all that. I have to say the set looks far more ornate than I expected it to. So I'm looking forward to it. I know a lot of people are down on this one already, but I'm keeping an open mind and I'm really looking forward to it. I saw the actual Peter Pan musical the other night in Hackettstown, New Jersey, where Leah Antinoni Lid, one of the great unsung performers of this area, playing Peter Pan and playing it butch, which I love when they do that, playing it like a boy. You know, I'll never forget when the VHS tape of Peter Pan came out, USA Today described Mary Martin as somebody who would have gotten a lot of playground beatings. And I think, and I won't disagree with that. So anyway, let's all pay attention to Peter Pan this week and see how well or not so well they do with it.
I purposely didn't watch that promo.
Oh, yeah?
Only because I thought I don't like to watch making of things before I see them.
Uh-huh.
But I would like to see it eventually. I mean, the making of thing,
sure,
as well as the show. Today, as soon as we disconnect, I'm going over to the Paley Center. They're screening in the large theater the color version, the final 1960 telecast of the Mary Martin version, which I do own on video at home, but I'd like to see it on the big screen with hopefully an enthusiastic audience. That'll be very interesting.
All right, so let's wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can go subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, your Android device, and stream us directly to you. Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Peter, Michael, or me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things that we've talked about today. I included links to, what did I grab here while we were chatting? The Midtown Men, they've got some great videos from the NJ PAC performance there, and Kristen Chenoweth's coming home, and a few other things there. So check out BroadwayRadio.com. And that's about it for right now. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Come here. The only completely unfunny people in the world are professional accordion players.
And me.
You're funny.
When have I been funny?
Well, I'm sure you could be funny.
How?
You can tell a joke.
Oh, no.
Yes, of course you can. Anybody can tell a joke.
Not me.
Yes, and I'm gonna teach you. I'm gonna tell you a joke, and then you're gonna tell it back to me. Okay?
Okay.
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 Here's the joke. This guy walks into a psychiatrist's office with a duck on his head. Psychiatrist says, "Can I help you?" The duck says, "Yeah, get this guy off my ass."
The duck talks?
Hmm? Yeah, the duck talks.
A talking duck?
Mm-hmm. A talking duck. All right now. You tell it back to me.
A man
Hold
was...
it! This guy is better than a man, okay?
Okay.
And you're doing fine.
Yeah.
Use your hands. Go ahead.
This guy walks into a doctor's office.
Psychiatrist.
Right. Sorry. I got it. This guy walks into a psychiatrist's office wearing a duck.
Whoa! Wearing a duck? No, he has a duck on his head.
I told you.
I threw you off. Go ahead.
This guy walks into a psychiatrist's office with a duck on his head. The guy says to the psychiatrist, "Can you help me? I have a talking duck on my head."
Oh. Oh.
What's this for?
Accordion lessons!